Travis?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He never got in personal contact with her. You know, we never saw any letters back from her saying, yeah, I'm interested. He just got a letter back from Travis saying, yeah, I think I know where she is. I'll talk to her. And, you know, the story goes that that she kind of fell for him a little bit and they started doing a thing together, and then he decided to come on out, and she agreed to come out with him for a short while. She didn't want to really join any rock and roll band. That was another thing that he had said. Well, there's a band up there that Chet, you know, Chet is managing. It's really going to be a good band and needs your help. And she really was negative about it until she really got into it. I was, you know, totally in back of Janis. I thought she was, you know, fantastic. I thought she was fantastic before we ever got her. We had seen her around with Larry Hanks and Roger Perkins and by herself, and she was just, you know, she was something else. And I could understand why she hadn't done anything.
The vibes of the album were just fantastic during that period of time. And it would be hard to say for me which is my most favorite place, the Avalon or the old Fillmore. And as they got into bigger and bigger halls, no way, you know, you just lose that intimate feeling. But the Avalon, just there were just some incredible scenes down there. Janis singing down there, I mean, it was magic. And there was no place else in the country that's ever come close to it.
Thank you.
Na 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 loneliness here for me, loneliness.
I saw Cream the first night they played here. I took a girl who had heard them. I had no idea what they were all about. I got two bottles of Ripple, got very drunk, sat in the front row. This guy comes out with his leopard skin robe or his fur coat, and I mean, I'm going to tell you, they blew me out. They just blew me right out of the hall. I could not believe that three people could make that much noise that well.
Down to the crossroads, down.
Thank you. Eric Clapton, please, on vocals.
The priority system was always pretty heavy at places like the Fillmore or Winterland or later the Carousel.
Lynn Hughes.
Just because so much fame was attached to playing those buildings, it became very important who played at 8 o'clock and who played at 9:15. And Graham actually managed to keep that from being a bummer. And he did run a good, tight show. And in that respect, I think that you could count on getting paid for an appearance, and you could count that if you went there, you would get on stage at approximately the time you'd been told, you know. For that reason, the show was much groovier than playing for some, what you could call fly-by-night promoters, mm-hmm. that you never ended up seeing the money or your check bounced later or something.
We paid the Matrix $30 to let us out of the contract, mm-hmm. and the club closed, and everyone in the club and the club owners went on over to Fillmore, which should have been Graham's first indication that Mother Earth was the largest abuser of the guest list that they would ever have, both on either coast.
Henry Carr.
If we hadn't had those Fillmore bookings, we wouldn't have been able to do anything, really, because for some reason, probably because we were willing to show up on 30 minutes' notice whenever a band couldn't get into the country or was busted or couldn't find a parking place, they'd call us. And we'd come over and work the gig. Mm-hmm. It was fine because we only had, I think it was about a 7 or 8 man band at that point. Tracy Nelson was the band. Tracy's voice carried us for a long time. Al's writing was eerie. It was always interesting to work for Graham because of the Bill Graham show that he put on. Mm-hmm. Mother Earth was, Wayne Talbert was never on time for a gig. There were numerous reasons. The majority of them were that just Wayne always had to stop off in the Fillmore somewhere. And sometimes, I'm grateful to Bill Graham for that thing. In that on several occasions, because we were the opening band, the third band down the line, almost overpaid, Graham would hold the show until Wayne got there, and usually would yell at me or put me to work handing out posters, stacking apples, just the normal. Couldn't get a hold of Wayne, and I was always handy to grab and yell at, so it was punishment by guilt by association, I guess it would be. Bill was never unbearable. Anyone that paid the money he paid could not be unbearable. I mean, he had an extreme temper that was uncomfortable at times.
like I said, he was just really fair to us. And also, like, the stories I'd hear about certain people he kind of rub on or put down or whatever, from what I could tell, they deserved it. They come strutting into the Fillmore thinking they were God's answer to the, you know, we want this such and such refreshments, we want pink carpets, and I kind of, he'd just go, you don't need that, you're supposed to make music, you don't need, which is how I felt about it, too. All that stuff was peripheral.
John Fogerty.
You know, be serious. I'll pay you a lot, or I'll make you comfortable. You need a certain microphone. You need a certain kind of lights, but don't ask for ladies of the night or just BS from showbiz. I mean, to this day, I've not changed my philosophy about all of that. To me, music is music, and music makes you high. And that's corny, and I suppose John Denver will do a song about that. But when you're really happening, it's you're high. You're just right. And the very first time we played the Fillmore, as opposed to the smaller places or whatever, I think we were second billing, and I think it was Steppenwolf, but I'm not sure. Anyway, we got a standing ovation, and that probably to this day means more to me than anything else, because like I keep saying, I felt like we were outsiders. We were hillbillies coming in to play the Fillmore in San Francisco, where all this stuff that I didn't understand was going on, all the druggos and all that. And everybody said, well, they don't dance, man. They just contemplate. They just sit there and dig your guitar riffs and your textures and your sounds and all that, and dig what you're saying, man. That was a Creedence cliche. After a while, we go, dig what he's thinking, man. Anyway, we got a standing ovation. I came home so high from that, just freaked out. In fact, after it happened, I walked off the stage. They're still cheering. I hand this guy my guitar and say, here, man. And we went up to my dressing room, and I just kind of walked around in a circle, and we're all going, wow, wow, great, great. About 10 minutes later, somebody says, where's your guitar? Jeez, I don't know. I mean, if you knew me, you know how persnickery I am about my guitar, especially then. It was the only one I had.
Right.
And I just handed it to some guy. I mean, just...
And,
here, man.
And
see ya.
Did you get it back?
Oh yeah.
You did get it.
He
back.
Was sitting there, and he says, well, here it is.
I started to walk with it, man, but then I thought.
No, not at all. He was sort of playing it, I think.
Keep on fighting. Thank you.
We're going to go back into the ballrooms in a moment. I want to remind you that later on, after the talkies on Sunday, tomorrow, Dave McQueen's your guide, along with Scoop Nisker for a two-hour pageant of the drug scene, featuring interviews recorded in the Haight-Ashbury in 1968, and a conversation with a narc who spent that time posing as what else but a hippie. Let's go back to the ballrooms.
They got me twice at the Fillmore. The first time, they had a bunch of the soda cans in the dressing room, and I drank a Coke. And they can almost time while Bill is going to take the group off the stage. He's going, then he's going to come in and say, "Hi, guys," and then he's going to go out and he's going to grab a Coke, because that's what I always did. And they had stuck a hypodermic needle through. And I was very aware of what I was doing, and I had a very good time. And I conducted the Grateful Dead for about 3 hours. And I thought I was absolutely brilliant. Mickey Hart asked me to join the group as the percussionist for the next tour.
the process that led into the Carousel?
We actually set out, all of us together, looking for something like that, to become like the People's Ballroom. It was because the Straight Theater didn't make it, and I don't know what the reasons were behind that, but I don't. You probably ought to talk to some Straight Theater people, because they were certainly part of the...
Talk to the Resners and
yeah,
Mr. Green.
Great, and, great, because that was a real part of the street, for sure. But we were really just brought down with the competition going on between Chet and Bill. And we hoped that we could come up with a ballroom that would bridge that gap and become a place where we could get back to the kind of acid test days where we could create stuff further than just a musical show from the stage and there being that real gap between stage and audience, you know. And that place for many months did become just that. And it did become a meeting place, and it was going around the clock. And there was an electronics lab workshop there, and there were plenty of community affairs there. And we had those Tuesday night jams that were a chance for bands to play that couldn't get a chance anywhere else, certainly not with Bill or Chet, because it wasn't competitive enough, you know, and they didn't have a big enough draw. And the place was very good for that. It was ultimately... the fact that so many people got involved in the thing that we had to shut it down, you know, because we couldn't charge admission anymore. Mm-hmm. And because somebody had climbed up on the marquee at the last...
Free City thing?
Yeah, they changed Free City to read Free Nice. And that was a Sunday night affair, and Monday morning, 8,000 people called the chief of police and said, hey, we just rode by the... and up on the marquee and said, and we want that place closed down. It was very good for all of us at that ballroom.
When the groups went into the Carousel, very much. Yeah, I didn't think it was right, because I thought the Fillmore and the Avalon helped these groups become who they were, and then they were going to try to put out of business. I mean, obviously, you know, it's so easy to say, we have a bigger place, we really don't want to hurt you, but we're going to hire the bands that you used to have. So it was all done in the way of, hey man, we dig you, you know, but f*** you. What is that? Is that any different than saying "fuck you"? Just what, with a little parsley on the plate? Tastes the same.
Carousel was really a lot of fun when we had it. It was really a lot of fun. It was a tremendous scuffle, but it sure was fun. Everybody who was involved in it so soulfully. Like, the food there was like the best in San Francisco, no kidding. There was just great lady cooks in there. Annie Corson, who's just a legendary cook, and, you know, head circles, and just was doing the food there, and all these different people. There was an office the Black Panthers had there, and the Chicano scene had a little scene going there during the day, and then there would be musicians jamming in the back room or on the stage. Mm-hmm. And it was just great, you know, it was just great. It was like a hot little community center. A Rackow pretty much ran mm-hmm. it, and of course it failed miserably. Because it was one of those kind of things where the overhead was higher than you could make at the door, you know. And we always played
contract.
There for free, you know, stuff like that. So we were able to keep it floating just for a certain amount of time. We didn't want to sacrifice. We didn't want to tear the place up and jam more people into it. You know, we wanted to keep it with its own flavor, you know, roomy and everything. And it was nice. It was a good place.
And it also was good because in an effort to save it, we had a series of meetings there in the restaurant. Where we called upon the might of the musical community. And similarly to the meetings to save the Family Dog on the Great Highway, it was a chance for the light shows and for the bands and for their managers and for everybody to get their say on what they thought about the viability of a communally operated ballroom. And Janice was great at that meeting. Everybody attended it, all Big Brother, Quicksilver, Starship, Airplane, Grateful Dead, loads of people, you know, plus the Pulteys and the Thompsons and everybody, you know.
What was Janice saying?
Yeah, she was saying community bullshit, this ain't a community, you know. If this were a community, we wouldn't have these problems. You fell, talking to Ron, you fell into the very same thing that Chet and Bill were doing. You tried to compete, and you can't compete with those guys. They know how to do it better than you do and better than we do. We should let them do what they're good at, and we'll do what we're good at, you know. We're good at making music, and this has got nothing to do with making music. This is running a business. Your overhead's too high. I mean, she's just strictly business, you know. She was right. She's absolutely right. It led to a discussion of what our community was all about.
We had that Free City show there.
Mm-hmm.
That turned into that was another one of those banana scenes, you know.
What was happening in it?
All kinds of things. There was a fire going on in the middle of the ballroom there. There were guys burning things and all kinds of weird, those kind of weird drunks stumbling in off the street, you know, and weird vagrants and Hell's Angels and just all kinds of strange shit going on, you know, just lunacy.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit of real old-time lunacy. It was loony. I remember there's all kinds of weird things, like somebody brought in a butchered sheep or something like that, and there was somebody paid with a limb of this butchered sheep, you know, so in the cash register was this bloody stump, you know, sticking in there, and a whole bunch of dollar bills gummed together with lamb's blood, and, you know, all this weird, you know, it was really weird, surreal, you know, utterly. But that was that thing, and it had to do with the definition of what free was, you know, which was preoccupation of all of ours and the one time. What is free exactly? How free is free?
Mm-hmm.
It was like pushing that definition. So free is, you're free to come into my house and stay for as long as you want to, if that's what freedom is, but I'm free to snuff you if I don't like you. Because it's like, you're free, but so am I, Buster.
Love my uncle, for God rest his soul.